Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good morning, Ned.
Ciao, Davide.
Where are you?
I'm at the Giro d'Italia.
I know that. You say that every day, so what's new?
Sono stanco, ma eccitato.
In an overly ambitious attempt to never stray farfalle from the daily goings-on of this year's Giro d'Italia, Ned Balti and I will be speaking every morning to recap the goings-on of the day before. I'm David Miller, and I'll be hosting the show from the comfort of my home in Girona.
And I'm Ned Balting, and this is what I laughably call a profession.
How's Italy?
It's all right, David. It's actually looking and feeling very much like France today because late on yesterday evening when we drove from the finish line in Novara to today's finish line, we're still in Piemont, by the way, we ended up in a hotel. What's it called? The hotel... I actually can't remember. I don't even know why I'm trying to remember.
But it looks like it's got like a kind of movie theme that looks like an old kind of reel of film.
Well, I hadn't realised that until you pointed it out. You're just looking over my shoulder.
Cinquecento door.
No more Cinquecento door. That's gone. That's a couple of hotels in the past already. I can see I think it's the Asti Hills just outside my window. But mostly I can see an industrial estate, to be perfectly honest, David.
Standard.
What appears to be, looking out the window now, there is a porcelain, what do you call it, a tile shop. Tiles, exactly. There's that kind of thing. I think there's some sort of car showroom. And there's a German supermarket chain called Pennymarkt. And I was quite excited when we arrived yesterday to see that there was a branch of Pennymarkt here. And so I, instead of eating with the communal dinner that is laid on for RCS employees, which is always a bit painful, to be honest, I actually just went and got some salami and... A bit of stale bread.
I'm really can feel your fatigue.
Yeah,
today
a little bit. I'm a little bit tired, but I've made myself a cup of tea. So I've bought a kettle. Did I tell you that?
You did tell me that.
We've already got to stage. I'm just repeating stuff.
Stage three. Well, we've only done two.
I know. Three. We haven't really solved that conundrum of whether this is stage two or stage three, really, have we? So I came up with I did think about that a little bit, David, because we discussed it on yesterday's pod. Was yesterday stage one or stage two pod? And I think you and I slightly disagreed, but you very kindly went with my suggestion. But I'm not convinced mine was right. So my potential solution was to call this pod 2.5.
So we're kind of playing catch up now, so we can get back to.
Well, we just position it in the middle. It's 2.5.
Oh, that's. I see what you mean. It is. It's 2.5.
2.5. So it's a bit about yesterday and a bit about today. It's okay. Crazy.
That makes total sense. I'm happy with that.
All right. Okay.
Yeah, that's cool. So tell me about your. Let's start with how your day started yesterday, Ned. Considering we're on a bit of a Ned's tour of Italy here, what did you do to start the day yesterday?
Well, I did a podcast with you, David.
That was before the day started.
That was still the day. It was so early, it was ridiculous. I did a podcast with you, and then I hung up on that and sent you my audio file, so to speak, for you to edit. You're doing all the editing and all that. And then I put my running shorts on and I went for a run. And yesterday in Novara, as I think I told you in the podcast, we were surrounded, very flat bit of Piemont, and we were surrounded by rice paddy fields, which is something I'd never seen before, actually. I kind of didn't, weirdly, I didn't really know they were a European phenomenon. I mean, obviously, rice has been cultivated in Europe for a long time. I just didn't know it was grown in Piemont. And I've certainly I haven't been to the Far East very often, so I've never seen paddy fields before. So it's a very flat run, and it was very, what's the word? It was kind of like out, 90-degree turn. Left 90-degree turn, because I was going around kind of quadrants, because they're all laid out.
It's like Minecraft.
Exactly. It was a Minecraft run. and on to my left and my right, each time, it's kind of, I was running along the dikes sort of thing that separate all these fields. And I was kind of marvelling at the irrigation network and the system of sluices and canals that actually keeps these paddy fields topped up, and failing to understand them completely, because how can... Well,
we've had... It's Italians, they're really good at it, at making water flow.
But how do you make water flow constantly downhill? Because that's the only way it never flows uphill. How do you make water flow downhill all the time on a completely flat landscape? It's kind of magic.
Okay, I'm going to take you back to briefly, because we're actually immediately straying far, and I apologise to our listeners, is when we were in Provence at the Tour de France a couple of years ago, and we were bamboozled by the aqueduct it's near Nîmes, and the fact that it had to do that detour of like 60 kilometers. And what did it have, some average of like 2 centimeters or 3 centimeters? It dropped like every 500 meters or
just,
I was going to be, I'm just floating facts there, but we were just in awe of the fact. So I guess they do the same. They're just really good at just measuring really tiny increments of descent. Cause I guess it doesn't need much, does it? As long as they keep it clear.
Any amount of downhill is enough. I suppose you're right.
Any amount of downhill is enough.
It's
gravity. Yeah, it's Earth.
Fair dues. But the low light of my run yesterday was, and I want to appeal to the ornithologists amongst our listeners here, because there were some very specific birds that I've completely failed to Google. But they were kind of, they're about the size of a magpie, or maybe a little bit bigger than a magpie, a little bit smaller than a gull. Quite delicate, black and white birds. So mostly black wings, but with a kind of white belly, I think. And they were clearly nesting in the banking of these kind of canals, for want of a better word. And as I ran past, I noticed that they're getting incredibly agitated every time I came close. The parents, I think, trying to warn me away from their nests. And they had a very distinctive call. It was a kind of... kind of cool. And one of them in particular started attacking me, very sharp beak, and it started sort of dive bombing me. And if you'd seen me, David, I was literally all on my own in a flat Piemont landscape, surrounded by paddy fields, running away from a very small bird.
Ned, was any of these...
What have you Googled? What have you Googled? What was your Google search?
Black and white attacking bird.
That second one. What's that second one? Might be that.
That's a magpie. Oh boy.
Oh, okay. I don't know.
I think it could have just been an Italian type of magpie.
Could have been. Had a very sharp, slightly curved beak. So if anyone knows the black and white, quite vicious, very protective of their young birds of Piemont with very sharp beaks who attack British runners.
Good, Ned. Yeah. So now we've done the pod. You've had your run.
Yep.
Now you get to the race, and
oh yeah, there was a race.
It was quite a moving stage yesterday, wasn't it? Not since the actual momentum inertia, but the actual memory of Wouter Weiland.
Well, ever since this Giro's got underway, it's been a succession of anniversaries. We spoke about the 160 years of the Italian kingdom. We spoke about 90 years of the Maglia Rosa. There was another anniversary yesterday. It was 75 years since the last king of Italy, Umberto II, was ascended to the throne. And it was also, David, yesterday, 10 years since the death of Wouter Weiland on the Giro d'Italia in 2011 on May the 9th. And the race... observed a minute silence before they rolled out from Stupinigi yesterday, with all the jersey wearers, including Filippo Ganna in the Maglia Rosa at the front. Ganna clearly knew exactly, just you could tell by his kind of demeanour on the front, why
the minute silence was being observed, even though 10 years ago he was a teenager. You know, he was 13, 14 years old. And it was a genuinely moving affair. But I mean, I have to ask you, were you aware yesterday that it was 10 years since you were on the race and you were in a very particular position on that day?
No, I wasn't, if I'm totally honest, until I started seeing it on social media and articles popping up. And it's not, thankfully, it's not something that I try to remember. It's something that's embedded. I can never forget it because obviously I was in the leader's jersey that day, or took it the day that he died. And then it was my responsibility to lead the peloton on today, actually, it would have been, which would have been that year, the 80th anniversary of the pink jersey. So it's a really weird couple of days for me, and it was a really weird couple of days for the whole race. And Wouter Weyland and his family and his sisters kind of been on and off in touch in the years past. And I think since I wrote my book and I wrote a piece, the whole chapter on this event itself, and I think she got in touch after that as well. So it's something that's, yes, I don't really have words for it, to be honest with you, because it was just something that happens that you don't want anybody to experience. And the whole peloton, I think it was one of the times the peloton was most touched and unified ever, really, that day, the next day when we rode, because he was such a liked character, and we had his best friend in our team as well, and Tyler Farrer. So it really hit home with us more so because we knew that he was best friends with him. They lived and shared off bike times in Ghent. And, so it was just a poignant, let's say.
David, for those who don't know the story, just explain what happened the following day in terms of the race and your involvement in how the peloton sort of behaved collectively the following day.
So when something doesn't really happen, but and for that reason we didn't really know what to do. And the evening of the day that Wouter died, I'd been given the pink jersey, and all of a sudden I became the representative for the riders. It's quite a phenomenal thing. And I guess it was a combination of things. It wasn't as if I was a neo-pro. I was pretty late in my career and was outspoken with the media. So I think the peloton was quite relieved that it was me. But it did mean that we didn't know how to ride. There was all this talk of not racing the next day. Or what are we going to do? Are we just going to do part of it? And so eventually I couldn't sleep that night, obviously, because I was so just wondering what to do. And I woke up in the morning and I went to breakfast, and I still remember this. And I was embarrassed. I didn't know whether I was supposed to take control or anything. And because I was just overwhelmed with everything that was going on. I stayed with Tyler in his room most of the evening, making sure he could sleep. So I had kind of stayed with him and looked after him. And when I went to breakfast the next morning, we were about six teams in our hotel, I guess. And then riders just kept coming up to me and patting me on the back and shaking my hand. Not in congratulations for the previous day, but just as a, you've got this. Like, you know what to do. We'll follow whatever your lead is. And my kind of insecurity of not sleeping all through the night of wondering what to do was then bolstered. And I felt my kind of, I started to sit up slightly straighter in my chair and not hide from everybody. And so then I made the decision. I went to my room, got my pink jersey, and went down to the team bus and just sat there, waited to go. And when I got there, went to where the directors sportifs were having their big meeting, trying to decide what to do. And I still remember this. This was amazing. And it was, you're going in there, it was so noisy because everyone was just trying to figure out what to do. Certain riders were saying this, press were saying this. There was obviously a lot of uproar about how it had been handled as well, the danger of the descent and different things. And the moment I walked in, the whole place went silent. And they just looked at me, and something I could hear, like, Maglia Rosa, Maglia Rosa. And that's it. Heard that whisper around the whole room. And I saw Mauro Vegni, and I went and spoke to him because he was the technical director at the time. And then a couple of other guys, and I said, look, this is what we're going to do. We're going to ride today. And every single team, so I think it was actually 220 kilometers that day's stage, and we're 22 teams. I said, we'll do 10 Ks each in reverse order of the GC. So the last team on GC will do the first 10 Ks, and then we'll just do that. 10 Ks, and everyone rides through, and we'll just keep the momentum up. And that's how we'll ride him. We're not going to do a procession. We'll ride with discipline, and we'll ride with authority and respect. And that's what we did. And it was a, and then with 2Ks to go, we let, it was Leopard was the team that he was on, drift off the front. And with Tyler went and joined them. And so it was Tyler and that, that team, and Tyler was just an uncontrollable emotional mess, rightfully so. And I still regret, one of my biggest regrets from that day is there weren't, was when I crossed the line, I was so tired from the previous day, the previous night, not sleeping, the stress of that day. And I just wanted to hide. So I got across the finish line and just went straight into where the podium is and didn't go and see Tyler. And Tyler had just broken down completely. And I was one of his best friends at the time and had stayed with him the whole night before. But I didn't want to go and see him and kind of hug him in public because I thought I'd break down. I thought it just it felt that I was being very British and I didn't want to show emotion. And that's still one of my biggest regrets, that I didn't just go and look after him because I was a kind of a big brother to him. But yeah, so it was a pretty powerful day. And it's one, as I said, I don't need to kind of commemorate because it's always there.
Amazing stuff, David. Did you watch yesterday's stage?
I did. Again, with Archibald, we watched the final.
Well done.
I know. Yeah, well, no, I had the privilege of dipping in and out in it.
I watched all of yesterday's stage, David, and I watched it without commentary. You know that thing? I was reminded of your observation. I think you made it a few years ago. You know, me and Ned, we watch cycling without commentary.
It's really hard. You ever tried to speak through a whole bike race? Oh. I did that because I turned on 125Ks to go, and I was like, ooh. And it was, but then my sixth sense came in because then I turned on a little while later, well, probably about 3 hours later, and Archie called it. How many Ks is it? Oh, no. He said, how many Ks to go? And I called it, probably about 20. And it came on and they were going under the 20 banner. Oh, and I was like, yes.
Yeah.
And then I went away and waited for 5Ks to go.
That's always a bit of a point in a bike race, isn't it? Especially a stage like that. And when we're commentating,
yeah.
You have to go, quite often our producer director will come in our ears and go, 20K to go. Go on, give us a new in. And you have to go, you in. 20 kilometers to go, you know, like that. Yeah, forgetting the fact that I've already commentated for 150, you know. There was a really bad...
Because I was going to say sorry, Ned, because I was, as I was following it on the social stuff, I suddenly saw people laughing about an intermediate sprint, which I haven't seen since.
Oh, it was brilliant.
Tell me about it.
Well, it was basically, you know how quite often, and it's normally a Vuelta thing, but... quite often we commentate to the wrong point in the race. So, we never quite know where the arch is, especially for the intermediate sprint. It always, you know, especially at the Vuelta, they sometimes don't even bother with an arch. You know, it's really hard to pick. Well, basically, they sprinted just as if we were commentating at the Vuelta. And it came from the peloton. So the gap was about a minute. So two Italian riders who were in the breakaway rolled through and took the first 2 points at the second intermediate sprint. And then the camera cut straight back to the peloton, who were about a minute and a half behind. But they were in a full-blooded sprint, and Sagan was there and Viviani was there and Gaviria was there. And then all they'd done was sprint for the 20-kilometre arch, and then the sprint was about 500 metres further up the road, and only Gaviria cottoned on. And they kind of, and then he started sprinting again. He had a quick look at Viviani, and Viviani went, come on then, let's go. And Sagan went, oh no, guys, no. Oh no, you're
not white and red guy.
Gaviria guy, you win the sprint. So it was quite funny. They had a bit of a laugh about it, but it was bike racing, isn't it? I mean, I don't think they'll make that mistake again, but it reminded me of that thing they do at the Vuelta, David, that every year trips me up, where they put to satisfy the sponsors, I guess, they put the, on a summit finish that carries King of the Mountains points as well, they put the King of the Mountains arch just about 300 meters back down that climb, don't they? Even though that's not the King of the Mountains finish line at all. That the finish line is actually the summit finish, the finish line of the... But they put the arch somewhere else.
It's horrible.
That was quite amusing.
Bike racing.
Not much else was amusing about the yesterday stage. It was pretty dull. Except for a really ineffective Vincenzo Albanese from Sean Yates's, Ivan Basso's and Alberto Contador's Aiolo Cometa team, who are making their grand tour.
Yeah, I keep forgetting about them.
Yeah, well, they're here. They're now an Italian team. Actually, they've got a big sponsor and they want to go world tour. in the next 3 years. Aola was a big internet service provider from Varanasi, and the CEO of that company is a mate of Ivan Basso's. And
perfect.
And so there used to be a Spanish team, and now they're Italian, and I think they will be the next Italian World Tour team. This is their Giro d'Italia bow. And Vincenzo Albanese, who's their rider in the most predictable breakaway in the history of road racing yesterday, featuring one Bardiani, one Androni, and one Aiolo.
Oh, lovely.
Perfect. Albanese, he picked up the only King of the Mountains yesterday, got the King of the Mountains jersey, and then had a mechanical on the on this uncategorized climb, the last little climb of the day, had a rear wheel puncture. And it was as if I was the Aiolo Cometa mechanic, David.
Oh, no.
I got out of the Aiolo Cometa car, and I looked at his rear wheel, and I kind of went back to the car quite slowly, got what I thought was the right Allen key, came back.
Are you serious?
I kind of fiddled with it a bit, didn't budge, and I kicked it, couldn't quite... Then I went back and got what looked like a Black & Decker. Went back casually like that and had a little fiddle. Couldn't get the rear wheel off, really. So then I kind of like, reluctantly went back to the car, went to the roof and picked a random bike off the roof and got that down instead because I just couldn't get the rear wheel off and gave it to him. And then the best thing of all, this terrible non-wheel change that happened was that... after all this, Albanese kind of took his little computer off his handlebars and put it on his new, spare bike, and then kind of got on, and it was on a climb as well, as on the foot of a climb, and just had to get going on his own, and the mechanic didn't even push him off. Because he was still just stood looking at the defunct bike, staring at it, going, "When I get back to the hotel, I'm going to have to sort this." Aren't I? Thinking to himself, you know, it was.
I bet he's climbed back into the car, went back to sleep.
Yeah, it was very funny. It was that was amusing.
But then I did watch the sprints. I mean, I just jumped there.
Yeah, let's talk.
What happened with UAE?
Mate, that was amazing.
So I don't know, actually, I should have looked already whether they've kind of said anything, the riders.
No, I've been looking. They haven't.
Okay, so what looked like it happened, they had Gaviria for the sprint, right? But his lead-out train was Max Riquese, who we know, the Argentinian lead-out man, formerly Quickstep, and Sebastian Molano, and a big, big old unit. He's a Colombian rider. But they were kind of, all three of them were separated from one another. No one was on anyone else's wheel. Riquese was in the middle. Gaviria was four or five riders back in around about 10th position. And Molano was kind of right towards the front in about second wheel. And in the final couple of hundred meters, Riquese looked over, he kept looking over to see where Gaviria was, couldn't find him, and I think Riquese was cooked. He pulled out of the line, pulled the pin, and sort of drifted over to the left-hand side of the road. And then he watched the following unfold, right? He watched Molano, who had no idea where Gaviria was, but knew he kind of wasn't on his wheel, kind of start to slow up a little bit as the sprint unfolded. And then he saw Gaviria, who's looking quite good, actually, kind of doing a full-on repositioning sprints to get somewhere close to the front and looking for room up on the right, really close to the barriers. And he ended up coming right up towards where Molano was beginning to slow down. And Riquese saw this. And you can see in one of the shots in particular, you see Riquese getting on the radio and shouting, right? And I think he's saying to Molano, watch out, here's Gaviria, Fernando's there. At which point Molano looks to his left, the wrong way, and because he looks to his left over his shoulder, he kind of veers to the right, right? And at that, and only a little bit, but that was precisely the moment at which Gaviria was looking for this non-existent space. And the effect of that was that Molano took Gaviria into the barriers, and boy, was he lucky. I mean, the barriers did their job, actually, and held him up.
I was just about to say, it's barriers because he's just slid along them and managed to pull himself back off.
Raising the skin off his knuckles, potentially, you know, like that.
In old school cycling, that would have been handlebars caught and steel bars and mass pile up and everything.
Well, on a day when, you know, a lot of the talk was about Groenewegen. And what happened to Jakobsen.
I was watching that whole sprint unfold, actually.
It's a weird sprint.
I mean, Gaviria did, he's been all very diplomatic about that incident, saying these things happen, etc. There's not much, which is true, there's not much you can say about that. But I was watching Groenewegen and thinking, how hard is it going to be for him to come back? Because he was a really aggressive sprinter, you know? He would get in, I wouldn't say trouble, but all sprinters do. They're bargy, they're pushing in the way, they'll find gaps that don't exist. He's got to be like, everyone's just going to be watching him. And everyone needs to already critic him and just say, you can't race like that. It's dangerous. That's a real monkey to have in your back for him.
Yeah.
And the fact he got third yesterday was pretty impressive, to be fair.
Yeah. And he got third. It was a very strange sprint yesterday. And hats off to Tim Malia, by the way, who's had a wonderful campaign in 2021 and brilliant for Alpecin.
You mentioned him beforehand.
Yeah. Well, he's been winning lots of races, in a team that they're the top Pro Tour team. But I didn't know that he was capable
of. He's 28.
Yeah, he's been around a bit, former Belgian national champion. But I mean, he's suddenly. But what the lesson I draw from this is, I don't know who's the fastest sprinter anymore.
And another thing I was thinking of, because it's almost like Cav's kind of just taken a gap out of one generation and is coming back in again.
Incredible.
When you look at it. So the way Mark Cavendish was racing at Turkey, and we saw this whole new generation of sprinters coming through, and it's been chaotic, but it seems totally open again. Mm. This doesn't seem to be much organisation. There's kind of, I think, chaotic. I mean, that's a very, very nature of bike racing now. Those sprints are kind of lower priority for teams.
Well, that's a very good point. There are only six opportunities tops for sprinters at the Giro. That's one of them ticked off. Wednesday is the next opportunity. Do you know what, David? Mark Cavendish was offered a start at the Giro, I understand. And for whatever reason, didn't take it. I wonder if he's regretting that. He could have been right in the thick end of this race,
He probably could have done, but maybe he's going for putting all his eggs in the basket for Tour de France, especially when you see that Sam Bennett's leaving to Koenig Quickstep next year. It kind of, that could change things a little bit for him as well. If he's, I've been following him, he's, I don't know. It's just, you can never write him off, and we were all writing him off, and then it's like, then he's back doing this sort of thing. Now it is Turkey, but let's see. But I think now with Sam Bennett going, his status within De Koenig Quickstep goes up again a notch.
The rider he beat four times in Turkey was Jasper Philipsen, who is the marquee sprinter for Alpecin Fenix, for whom Tim Malia is the B sprinter. You know, so kind of. Yeah. I know, but join the dots, and you have to say, why not? Cavendish kind of belongs in the top anyway.
Yeah.
But the fact that Mark Cavendish isn't here, and nor is Sam Bennett, actually had ramifications yesterday for Remco, David. Because as I alluded to, this is the first time Quickstep have ever gone to a Grand Tour without a sprinter, ever.
Really?
I've been through all of their Grand Tour selections throughout their history. And they've never not gone to a Grand Tour without someone who can sprint.
But that is a crazy fact.
It took me a long time to research. but because they don't have a sprinter for the final, because they weren't interested at all in protecting a sprinter in the final, they were able to dedicate a few resources to the second intermediate sprint yesterday. And Ilio Kesa, as a result of not having to look after a sprinter in the final, was able to lead out Remco Evenepoel with 24 kilometres to go at the second intermediate sprint to try and sprint for bonus seconds. And that was really significant. So Kesa was released, didn't have to do a lead out for a sprinter, and the beneficiary of not having a sprinter was Remco. Remco picked
what's,
up
what's amazing with this,
two
though,
bonus seconds.
Is the fact that he's flicked his teammate for the leader's jersey. It goes to show there's no gifts at De Koenig.
They're level on GC. Remco had a 2 second deficit to Joao Almeida and just nicked those 2 seconds back.
But he's got to be at 200s. There was a 200s difference in the time trial. So it's put Evenepoel ahead of him.
Oh, has he actually gone ahead?
So it means at the summit finish, Evenepoel is now ahead if they finish together.
I think it backs up what you interpreted into Evenepoel's individual time trial.
He's going to win the Giro.
Yes, exactly.
Damn it.
Exactly. Said it. Remco, yeah, you've said it now. You've said it out loud. Yeah.
It's going to happen.
And likewise, so you're right. Yeah. And equally, I don't think we saw much from Marc Soler yesterday, did we? So I'm right as well. So.
Well, that's just continuing to happen, isn't it? Yep. Poor old Marc Soler. What else is going on, Ned?
Well, that's kind of yesterday.
We've got today's stage.
That's yesterday summed up. Yeah, today. Today. Because this is stage 2.5, let's not forget. Let's talk a little bit about today, which involves me getting my notes out, doesn't it? Today's a little bit longer than yesterday and a much more interesting parcours today. So we've got a few climbs. There are three categorised climbs and in the final 70 kilometres, and they're kind of quite punchy, actually, a lot of the climbs. And there's a final intermediate sprint as well, which is, if you look at the profile, on top of a climb, a kind of what looks like a 2 or 3 kilometres uncategorised climb. So it's tough, and I don't think it'll be anything like a bunch sprint. It's a Sagan day, if that's a shorthand way of saying that kind of thing, but could be really exciting. Could be wet as well. The weather's changed here. The clouds have rolled in and the forecast isn't great. We go from Biella, the provincial capital of Biella, in the province of Biella in Piemont, which is kind of top left-hand corner of Piemont, really. And we head southeast in a fairly straight line. Biella's a really lovely place. We should get some shots of the early 15th century Biella Cathedral, which has a kind of amazing looking... I'm kind of slightly overreaching in architectural terms here. It has an amazing looking kind of Moorish top style facade in white stone that's very beautiful. Unusual looking cathedral, not what you'd expect from kind of Gothic style of Italian architecture.
You're in deep now, Ned.
Yeah, I'm going deep, but I'm rolling with it. It's the centre of the wool industry. And it was severally kind of occupied by the French because it's very close to the French border. And as recently as 1859, so 2 years before the Italian kingdom was declared, it was besieged by the Austrian army in 1859 and then liberated by Garibaldi himself. But here's where, I'm not straying too far from the Giro d'Italia, here's where it links back to the race. This is, I'm still talking about the start town now, Biella. Up in the hills around Biella is the Sanctuary of Europa. Okay. Does that mean anything to you, David, in terms of cycling history?
No, it doesn't actually, unfortunately.
Well, I'm disappointed.
I probably should have.
I'm disappointed.
Sorry.
It should mean something to you. I'm disappointed by that. Six times it's been a stage finish at the Giro, the Sanctuary of Europa, which is a collection of chapels. It's a pilgrimage site up in the hills. And the last time was as recently as 2017, where Tom Dumoulin won the stage in the Maglia Rosa to consolidate his lead in the race. That was the year he went on to win it. But famously, in 1999, the stage to the Sanctuary of Europa was Marco Pantani.
I know.
The big comeback.
That's where he was.
Yeah, insane rampage from Pantani in the pink jersey. But what really interested me about, I tried to kind of read up a little bit about what it is that drives the pilgrimage up to the, you know, what's so special about Europa. And it's this. There is up there a 3rd century, depiction of the Madonna there that was brought to Italy, what we now consider Italy, brought to this this area by Saint, what was his name? I've got it on my notes here somewhere. Saint Eusebius. In the 3rd century. And it's this depiction of Madonna is one of many which are Byzantine in origins. And he bought it from the Middle East. That's as exact as I can be, somewhere in the Middle East in the 3rd century. And Madonna is depicted to be very dark-skinned, right? Essentially, she's one of the many black Madonnas. And this is a thing that I didn't realize at all, that in kind of early 3rd century, 2nd century, 1st century even, a lot of the depiction of Madonna, probably for extremely good reasons, paint Madonna as a dark-skinned, as a black person. And these Madonnas carry with them, in certain kind of strains of Catholic thinking and feeling, enormous heft. And they are celebrated, deified, if you like, with extreme kind of fervor and passion. And many kind of, they have a higher prevalence of attached sort of miraculous thinking to them. So they're imbued with a great deal more power. And there's a lot of kind of quite interesting thinking and writing about this in kind of, theological research about the connections made between, I'm uncomfortable saying it, but it is what they're, how they're referred to in theological thinking, but the black Madonnas and kind of pre-Christian pagan religious tropes. So So it's really interesting, and it's just a whole thing that I didn't realise. They tried to bring, apparently the legend is, they tried to bring the Black Madonna down from the hillsides where St. Eusebius had left it in the sanctuary, down into the town of Biella at one point. But when they tried to move it, she didn't want to be moved from her resting place, and apparently she became unbearably heavy. So nobody could actually move her. That's the kind of... So she wanted to remain up in the hills and in the sanctuary of Europa. So hopefully we'll see a bit of that, because it's an amazing story.
And what I'll do is, in the show notes, I'll put in, I found an article on the history of the Black Madonna of Europa.
Brilliant.
So I'll put that article in the show notes so people can go and check it out. It's amazing.
I'm really conscious when I, you know, because I skim around these, you know, this is the nature of grand tours, isn't it? I haven't got long to kind of absorb what is really quite important and complicated information. So I can only skim the surface. I'm very conscious that we have an erudite, an intelligent listenership, don't we, David? And a lot of people will know this much better than me. So if people want to put me right on certain things or just kind of fill in the gaps, you're very welcome. And if I've kind of got the story slightly wrong, I also apologise, but I'm doing my best. And we finish in a town called Canale today, after this series of climbs. So it should be a really good race today, by the way.
Very good.
The Canale is only 5,500 people, and it's a wine region, Roero wines, red and white wines, and also Roero Arneus Spumante fizzy wines. And it's a beautiful part of the world, surrounded by little gorges and canyons and ravines. So we've left where we finished today. We've left flat Piemonte, and we're into these little rolling hills. They're not mountains, but they're hills. And yeah, that's amazing. That's it. Yeah. What are you going to do today?
Thank you, Ned.
What's your plans?
What am I going to do?
Pop and edit this.
I'm going to edit this.
Yeah.
I'm going to go for a run.
What?
And then I'm going to do...
What?
Yeah, I'm doing sport again.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
And now it started. I got to run the West Highland Way.
Oh, yeah. What's happened to your collarbone, David? Because you broke your collarbone like a numpty. Oh, that's really disgusting. Oh, you're showing me a scar. It's not healed particularly well. That's really unpleasant.
Well, it had been. And then I was running last week and was doing... Went riding with some friends, did some sprints, and the end of the plate popped off. So it's sticking. So it's, but it's quite uncomfortable. I was in extreme pain for one day. So I'll tell you all about the West Highland Way tomorrow.
They're going to have to open you up?
Yeah, they will in 2 months. Yeah. I'm going to do it probably afterwards. I'll see how it goes in the next couple of weeks, and I might have to get it out before, but let's see.
What's the West Highland Way? What's the West Highland Way? What are you talking about?
Oh, well, I'll tell you all about it tomorrow because I'll get all the details up.
Sounds hard.
It's 150-kilometre trail in the West Highlands of Scotland.
On your bike?
No, running.
150 kilometres?
Yeah, and considering I can't do 3Ks with my wife at the moment, who I'm doing it with, who's super fit, I'm a little bit worried.
You better go out for a run, David.
I know. Put it this way. The Tour de France this year is going to be boot camp extreme.
Oh, no.
Just long. Yeah.
All right. Good luck. Looking forward to July.
Yeah, very good.
See ya.
All right. Bye.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact. You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.